So today we're reading from Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 10, Chapter 3, part of a special Janmashtami series, hopefully with the intention of bringing us into a mood of welcoming Krishna when he appears in a few days' time. Sri Sri Radha Gokula Nanda Ki. So we'll be reading chapter 3 today, texts 1 to 5. Which one is on the board? The fifth one. Okay. It's a translation by His Divine Grace, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Srila Prabhupada. Thereafter, at the auspicious time for the appearance of the Lord, the entire universe was surcharged with all the qualities of goodness, beauty and peace. The constellation Rohini appeared, as did stars like Ashwini. The sun, the moon and the other stars and planets were very peaceful. All directions appeared extremely pleasing, and the beautiful stars twinkled in the cloudless sky. Decorated with towns, villages, mines and pasturing grounds, the earth seemed all auspicious. The rivers flowed with clear water, and the lakes and vast reservoirs full of lilies and lotuses were extraordinarily beautiful. In the trees and green plants full of flowers and leaves, pleasing to the eyes, birds like cuckoos and swarms of bees began chanting with sweet voices for the sake of the demigods. A pure breeze began to blow, pleasing the sense of touch and bearing the aroma of flowers. And when the brahmanas, engaging in ritualistic ceremonies, ignited their fires according to Vedic principles, the fires burned steadily, undisturbed by the breeze. Thus, when the birthless Lord Vishnu, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, was about to appear, the saints and brahmanas, who had always been disturbed by demons like Kamsa and his men, felt peace within the core of their hearts, and kettle drums simultaneously vibrated from the upper planetary system. A purport. As stated in the Bhagavad Gita, the Lord says that His appearance, birth and activities are all transcendental, and that one who factually understands them is immediately eligible to be transferred to the spiritual world. The Lord's appearance or birth is not like that of an ordinary man, who is forced to accept a material body according to his past deeds. The Lord's appearance is explained in the previous chapter. He appears out of His own sweet pleasure. When the time was mature for the appearance of the Lord, the constellations became very auspicious. The astrological influence of the constellation known as Rohini was also predominant, because this constellation is considered very auspicious. Rohini is under the direct supervision of Brahma, who is born of Vishnu, and it appears at the birth of Lord Vishnu, who is, in fact, birthless. According to the astrological conclusion, besides the proper situation of the stars, there are auspicious and inauspicious moments due to the different situations of the different planetary systems. At the time of Krishna's birth, the planetary systems were automatically adjusted so that everything became auspicious. At that time, in all directions, east, west, south, north, everywhere, there was an atmosphere of peace and prosperity. Auspicious stars were visible in the sky, and on the surface, in all towns and villages or pasturing grounds, and within the mind of everyone, there were signs of good fortune. The rivers were flowing full of water, and the lakes were beautifully decorated with lotus flowers. The forests were full with beautiful birds and peacocks. All the birds within the forests began to sing with sweet voices, and the peacocks began to dance with their consorts. The wind blew very pleasantly, carrying the aroma of different flowers, and the sensation of bodily touch was very pleasing. At home, the brahmanas, who were accustomed to offer sacrifices in the fire, found their homes very pleasant for offerings. Because of disturbances created by the demoniac kings, the sacrificial fire had almost stopped in the houses of the brahmanas, but now they could find the opportunity to start the fire peacefully. Being forbidden to offer sacrifices, The Brahmanas were very distressed in mind, intelligence and activities. But just on the point of Krishna's appearance, automatically their minds became full of joy because they could hear loud vibrations in the sky of transcendental sounds proclaiming the appearance of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. On the occasion of Lord Krishna's birth, seasonal changes took place throughout the entire universe. Krishna was born during the month of September, yet it appeared like springtime. The atmosphere, however, was very cool, although not chilly, and the rivers and reservoirs appeared just as they would in Sharat, the fall. Lotuses and lilies blossomed during the day, but although Krishna appeared at 12 o'clock midnight, the lilies and lotuses were in bloom, and thus the wind blowing at that time was full of fragrance. Because of Kamsa's disturbances, the Vedic ritualistic ceremonies had almost stopped. The Brahmanas and saintly persons could not execute the Vedic rituals with peaceful minds. But now the Brahmanas were very pleased to perform their daily ritualistic ceremonies undisturbed. The business of the Asuras is to disturb the Suras, the devotees and the Brahmanas. But at the time of Krishna's appearance, these devotees and Brahmanas were undisturbed. Srila Prabhupada ki. Om Gyanati Mirandasya Gyananjana Shalakaya Chakshurun Militam Yena Tasmai Shri Gurave Namaha Nama Om Vishnu Padaya Krishna Prishnaya Mukhadeshwantanadam. Well, there's a wonderful verse and a wonderful purport and the start of a wonderful chapter of the Bhagavatam. And if there's one word which stands out during this whole series, it's auspicious. Just the sheer auspiciousness of Krishna's appearance, his impending appearance, is being felt before he has actually appeared. His appearance is described in detail as this chapter proceeds. And in the previous chapter, we heard something about the prayers that were offered by the demigods when they realized that Lord Krishna was soon to appear in the house of Vasudeva and Devaki. Well, in the prison house of Vasudeva and Devaki. So they came and they offered their respects, obeisances and prayers to Mother Devaki. And at this point, the Lord is just about to appear. And so he is making all these beautiful arrangements within the world. When I was reading this, I was thinking, this sounds like a nice place. I'd like to go there. How many of you would like to visit such a place? Such a beautiful place of great serenity. And actually we get a little hint as to what a wholesome, uplifting society environment is like. It includes beautiful heavenly scenes, twinkling stars, clear cloudless skies, nice sunshine, clear water, lakes with vast reservoirs, lilies, lotuses, all these auspicious plants. Flowers, leaves, cuckoos, swarms of bees. It's a very nice scene and a beautiful aroma as well, which calms and purifies everyone's minds. Also, in terms of the civilization, it is not that there is no civilization, no structures, no activities. These all take place also. It says decorated with towns, villages, mines and pasturing grounds. We tend to describe these as being rather problematic, typically. That, oh no, the hellish city. We refer to it as that. And then mines, you know, a place where Ugra Karma takes place. Well, actually, no, these things are all necessary as part of a society that thrives and moves forward. There are pasturing grounds, there are mines. The Supreme Lord supplies everything in abundance. If we behave properly and if we utilize only what is set for our use, one should accept only that which is set aside as his quota, leaving aside everything else, knowing well to whom it belongs. So that's the verse from the Ishopanishad. And so typically we see in today's day and age a slight contrast with this description. We see cities which are actually hellish for many people who live there. They're not places which are auspicious, wholesome. And then even if we venture into the countryside, where we may see some of these things, rivers, clear water, nice birds, swarms of bees. What we don't see is brahmanas and their fires, the fires of their yajñas. These are considered very, very beautiful. But these days they would be considered to be a source of pollution or even a health hazard. So we can see how what the contrast is between this description and today's world. But actually the yajñas, the fires burning, which in which sacrifice is offered by the brahmanas, is actually very auspicious for the entire world. Very auspicious for everyone. That is one of the beautiful traits of a nice scene. That there must be the fires of the brahmanas burning peacefully, undisturbed. No hurricanes to cause destruction, but steadily the flames are going upwards. Yajna is the basis for auspiciousness, actually, as the Gita explains, that when there is cooperation between men and demigods, prosperity will reign for all. So that arrangement has been set up by the Supreme Lord, that when the brahmanas on behalf of the whole of society offer yajna to the Supreme Lord, there is prosperity, grains come, rain comes, grains come. And when this aspect of yajna is not performed, everything becomes irregular. The rain may come still. Sometimes it comes in torrents when it's least welcome. But the problem is it doesn't come in a regulated, wholesome manner, which is beneficial. As Prabhupada says, when we chant, everything becomes regulated. So this description is mentioned here because it is something of a contrast to what was happening just prior to this point. As soon as Kamsa heard that the eighth child of Devaki would be the source of his destruction, he began a program of persecution. And even before that, just by his presence, there was all sorts of demoniac agendas. There were all sorts of demoniac propagandas flourishing. Now, the demoniac propaganda is directly opposed to the saintly propaganda. In the saintly world, in saintly civilization, you have all these pleasant, simple elements of natural beauty present throughout the whole country. And you have brahmanas, you have the whole of society following a type of a progressive lifestyle. Now, with Kamsa's reign, this was very much suppressed. And as it's stated here in this translation and the purport, the brahmanas who had been disturbed by the demons, like Kamsa, they were persecuted for lighting the sacrificial fire. When they performed Vedic ritualistic ceremonies, they would have consequences. So they were afraid. They were afraid of carrying out their religious activities. Probably in a similar manner to how different religions, different faiths have been persecuted at different places in the world over time, persecuted for following their traditions. So imagine how the brahmanas are feeling here. They're not allowed to do these things. And everything is inauspicious. All of these signs that are described here are described precisely because they did not exist before. But now, because Krishna has appeared in the womb of Devaki, and is shortly about to appear in person, his special energies are making a whole range of arrangements. The constellations have all moved into the correct places to be auspicious. People's minds are feeling peaceful. There's a wonderful set of scenery which has been produced. And all of these arrangements have been made to facilitate the Lord's plan. His plan is always mysterious. The Lord does appear when he feels there's a need. Paritranaya sadunam vinashaya cha duskritam dharma samstapanarthaya sambhavami yuge yuge. Whenever and wherever there is a rise of irreligion and a decline of religious practice, I descend. A predominant rise of irreligion. That seems to be the criteria. But still, the Lord, there's another factor, and that is the Lord's desire. And his schedule, his timetable. So we would all like the Lord to appear right now because we feel all those criteria are met. There is a predominant rise of irreligion. The society is troublesome. But that's not quite the Lord's plan. So he has his own plan. But at this point, his plan is about to manifest in a very special way for everyone in general. Everyone who's present in that in the world at this time will benefit now because of the Lord's arrival. And so these are just some of the insignificant side effects that happen. When the presence of the Lord is there, everything becomes auspicious. And people are struggling day in, day out with great difficulty, engaging in great, great works. Very heavy, heavy activities, as Prahlad Maharaj says. Great endeavors to get some prosperity, to get some peace. Everyone wants peace and prosperity, although there's always a group of individuals who are trying to deny precisely that to others. Sometimes peace is not desired by crooked individuals because they can flourish more and extract more when there isn't peace. They can use that circumstance to their benefit. So when there is a peaceful situation, they try to disrupt it. That's a symptom of the demoniac. It was a symptom in Kamsa. When Kamsa was present, he was doing precisely the same thing. And it's a general symptom that we find throughout the world today. So, we attempt to gain everything that Krishna supplies in this wonderful scene, but we attempt to gain it through very heavy, angry activities, the activities of Ugra Karma. And there is a world of difference between the two. One of them, the first path whereby we serve Krishna with great love, with great affection, for his pleasure. And then Krishna, in reciprocation, just to facilitate us, makes the whole situation beautiful and conducive. That is one category of interaction. The other category where we, through great technological expertise, through great systems, through great oppression, suppression, control, formulas, systems, heavy activities, using vast quantities of energy, which normally we would not be able to wield naturally, we try to extract forcibly from Mother Earth all the items that we need, and more. Therefore, the earth is full of mines all over the place. And that itself is a source of conflict. Who has the resources? Who controls the resources? So many wars have been fought on oil. Probably as time proceeds, they'll be fought on other rare elements. And we're starting to see little tendencies of that. Conflict based upon who controls resources. So this type of lifestyle is not really required when there is a mass a devotional attitude towards Krishna. Because instead of having to extract all these things with great politics, great endeavor, great ugra karma, Krishna supplies what we need naturally and peacefully in abundance. As Prabhupada says in the first canto, when there is a Krishna conscious environment, you know, there are jewels in the hills, there are minerals in the seas, there is ample grazing ground for the cows, lush green grasses, weather is regulated, everything is provided. The cows have fatty milk bags, plenty of milk is supplied in abundance, no cruelty required, no need for an ahimsa label as such, because there is no himsa. There is no cruelty, everything is ahimsa by definition. So when we serve Krishna with great love and affection, everything becomes auspicious. And that is the thing that those of demoniac nature don't like. So they don't like the idea that we surrender and serve the Supreme Lord. They like to think that they are in control and by their activities things happen. And just see what a wonderful illusion Krishna has created. That he gives ample reasons for persons who would like to think like that to continue to think like that for their entire life. Why? After all, it's obvious. if we set up a corporation which goes and mines some raw ingredients from somewhere, we've put in a lot of effort. You can see physically the machines working. You can see the laborers working. You can see all the soil piled up high. You can see all of that going on. And then you can see all the factories which extract and process that. And so it's very, very easy to see that clearly it is the work of man-made intelligence that is causing the production of these items. And then many stages of processing later to transform them into products. Maybe an iPhone, maybe some other desirable glittering object. It's all man-made, right? It's very easy to see. So someone who wants to think that they are the doer of activities has ample evidence around them to keep that illusion going. They've forgotten a few things along the way, as is the tendency. First of all the ingredients that they just extracted were not created by them. They extracted them. They did not generate them. Surely the person who generates something is far more, you could say, advanced or capable than someone who simply extracts something. Imagine, you know, you build something, you do some construction, and someone else comes and steals it. Who is actually more competent? The person who steals or the person who created in the first place? And even our process of extraction is so flawed. We leave pollution everywhere. We leave destruction on a massive scale everywhere where we extract anything. And then we have to have entire large formulas, global movements to try to acknowledge the fact that we're destroying the earth, when it's actually patently obvious for everyone to see, right from the beginning. We are also all guilty because we like the glittering products at the end of it. We like it. And so we are the fuel that keeps this process going. So this is kind of a depiction of a kind of dystopia based upon ugra karma, based upon the ego, that I am the controller, I am the doer. Now, I just mentioned the production of the raw items. Now, where does the intelligence come from for transforming those items? You could say books, studies, universities, research. But really? Did anyone invent any of those things themselves? Most great discoveries came as flashes of inspiration to the people who discovered them. They didn't follow some method by which a new discovery was generated. Definitely, based upon certain key principles, you can then work using elaborate mathematics, scientific techniques, formulae. You can definitely apply all of that and transform and produce something. But again, the intelligence, the consciousness, the ability to do that, we understand it comes from Krishna. I am the ability in man. No one has come into this earth full of abilities. We have certain instincts, maybe, certain base instincts that animals have. But after all, everything else, after that, everything that we now accept and utilize, our language, our speaking, our ability to interact with people, our ways of earning money, we learned all of that. So it's a perpetuation of a system. But all of these things can be supplied without such heavy activities taking place by Krishna. And this is the thing that those of demoniac nature do not want to believe. You can see from this description, there are still villages, there are still mines, there are still pasturing grounds, there are still systems by which wholesome life can take place. It's not that everything stops and everyone sits around doing nothing. No, but when Krishna is at the center, and the Vedic fires are burning, and yajna is being offered to Krishna, to the demigods, things happen in the world which are way beyond one's own ability or the ability of a country. Resources are supplied by Krishna, created by Krishna. New oil wells are discovered by magic. Krishna can do so many things which are well outside the bounds of any material calculations. And people don't like that. Those who wish to control don't like the very concept of that. Therefore they adopt a sequence or a model which allows them to continue to think that they are in control. It just takes a little virus, very minuscule item. Shri Shri Radha Gokulanandaki Jai. How much trouble has this tiny little entity caused over the last 2 years? This tiny little thing, which is a few proteins and a set of instructions and this and that. This little thing has caused havoc in the world. That's all it takes. Yet we are so proud of our civilization. A volcano erupts, buildings, everything are buried under piles of lava. A little earthquake comes along. Everything that we spent perhaps 10 years constructing is just reduced to rubble in a few seconds. That is the power of nature when she just shifts a little. A little itch. That's all it is for Mother Nature. She just moves a little bit and we move in a big way. So those are the aspects that people do not consider in the program of considering themselves to be the controller. Now, with this, the secret that we are given by our acharyas, by the scriptures, that we have to understand Krishna's nature. What I've said so far could be a little abstract. Okay, let's place our faith in Krishna and let's hope everything turns up. Well, that might happen. It will happen. Things will be supplied in abundance by the Lord in a very peaceful, wholesome way. But we do have to understand who Krishna is. Therefore, as Prabhupada says in the first paragraph here, janma karma cha me divyam evam yoveti tatvatah tyaktva deham punarjanma naiti mam eti sorjuna. That one has to understand the transcendental nature of the Lord's appearance and activities. Janma karma cha me divyam. Now, all of these words, these two words, janma and karma, they have a sense of irony with them when they're applied to Krishna. Because as we just read, Krishna is, he's one who's not born. He's one who is not born. The word janma doesn't really apply to him. Neither does karma. He's not affected by karma in that sense. But in another sense, if we look at those words as meaning appearance, and karma is activity, and the Lord does engage in activities, not of a material kind, but beautiful transcendental activities, which we are encouraged or invited to try to understand through Shastra. We can't understand them in any other way. Only through Shastra are Krishna's activities revealed to us and the secrets of his birth. When people do not understand the secrets of the Lord's birth, they speculate. They concoct ideas of what Krishna is, who Krishna is, what his birth means. They create in their minds different religious processes almost, all based upon misconceptions. But here in this, as this chapter unfolds, we will now see in great detail how Krishna's appearance takes place, the conversations he has in his four-armed form with Vasudeva and Devaki. Then what happens when he agrees very kindly to reduce himself to a normal human-like child. And then, coupled with all of that, the whole philosophical basis that allows us to not make the mistake of the Mayavadis, to not think that the Lord accepts a material body of goodness. In one place, Srila Prabhupada says, the biggest mistake of the Mayavadis is to think that when the Lord appears, he accepts a body of goodness. Now that sounds like a nice statement, doesn't it? The Lord is a nice entity of goodness. But within that statement, there is an offense made against the Lord. That one is attempting to glorify him using words used to describe matter, when the actual fact is that he has nothing to do with matter. So it's like praising someone when they're actually of nothing of the sort. So these are some of the things that we get specifically through the Gaudiya Vaishnav Parampara. This explicit clarity. This difference is emphasized greatly between the Lord's form and a form of matter. It's almost something that kind of slips you by. It's something you wonder sometimes, why is so much effort put into this? But it's crucial, because the Lord, when he appears in this form, as the deity, is Radha Gokulananda. When he appears in another form that is visible to the eyes of those around him, we should never make the mistake of thinking that is material. The Lord is spiritual at all times, regardless of the form that he appears to take. And so this is one of the points that we understand. And if we understand this, well, it is said that we are eligible to be transferred to the spiritual world, because we are aligned and we have opened our eyes to what the spiritual world is. We've made that leap. So Krishna appears. He appears. That's a whole drama in itself. I mean, nothing with Krishna happens in a standard, simple way. He's not born in the maternity ward and then, you know, cries a bit. And then no. Krishna appears. There's a whole scene created. He appears in a prison. He appears in the middle of the night. All the chains are all destroyed. The shackles that shackled Vasudeva and Devaki. Then a whole leela takes place where he's transferred. Yogamaya is exchanged. Just prior to that, Balaram has been transferred to the womb of Rohini. All these interesting things have happened. Mother Yamuna gives way. So many interesting activities happen, definitely not ordinary. So we are invited to just meditate sometimes on these things. This scene that's described to us today is a scene that we can just meditate on. We don't always need to go through Shastra and keep looking for things to apply in our lives. This is a very common emphasis that is placed, especially by those in the mode of passion. Shastra exists for my purification. We read Shastra and we try to extract one instruction, another instruction, another instruction for my benefit, so I can become purified. It's okay, there's nothing wrong with that. But that's not what Shastra is limited to, and that is not the only process for approaching Shastra. That process is adopted primarily by those who have a need to constantly acquire something and a need to constantly produce something. Some output, constant output. And constantly they need to consume something as well. So sometimes we approach Shastra like that. But Shastra is, has its existence well beyond whether it helps us or not. We are not the most important characters within this whole scene of Krishna's. Shastra is produced, Vedanta Krit Vedavit Evacham. Krishna manifests Shastra. He does so eternally. Shastra is manifest before there are people around. It is nothing but the sound vibration of the Supreme Lord. It's none different to the Lord. So the Lord is Shastra. Now we're talking today about the appearance of the Lord. But there's also something that happens at his disappearance. So we hear in the first canto of the Srimad Bhagavatam, Krishna Swadham Upagate Dharma Jnana Dibisaha Kalo Nashta Drasham Esha Puran Arkutunoditaha. Now that Krishna has disappeared, has gone back to his own abode, taking with him knowledge, religion, and all such practices, we have a problem. Krishna's gone, taking away everything that is auspicious. But to take his place, or the way he now manifests for our benefit, is that he comes through the Srimad Bhagavatam, through the blazing sunlight, the fire, Puran Arko Tunoditaha. He has appeared, he has descended through as the Srimad Bhagavatam. So when Krishna's person is no longer visible to us, is no longer manifest, his person is available here in the Srimad Bhagavatam. So that is Krishna. It's Krishna always, eternally. And so sometimes as we go through and we read verses like this, we don't have to keep trying to extract something from it. We can just meditate on this beautiful scene. That is a scene that comes as part of being in Krishna's world. In Krishna's world, even when he comes to this world, Bhoma Vrindavan, when he manifests Vrindavan here in the material world, Such decorations take place. There are beautiful phenomena. There are beautiful facilities. And just that meditation alone actually is our success. This was one of the items that was spoken by Narad Muni to Srila Vyasadeva when he was encouraging him to manifest the Srimad Bhagavatam. That when the people in this world meditate on and understand the Lord's appearance and his activities, especially his pastimes, they will feel satisfied at heart just by meditating on those pastimes. That itself will take their consciousness, just lift it out from its current situation and place it in a transcendental place. Yasya vaishru yamanayam krishna paramapurushe bhaktir utpadyate bhumsam shoka moha bhayapaha. Just by giving submissive oral reception to topics of Krishna, everything auspicious happens. Bhaya disappears, fear, hankering, lamentation, they all disappear. Just through hearing about the scene of Krishna. So we can always apply different ways, different approaches to the Bhagavatam. Now clearly Bhagavatam and Shastra is also created, has been manifested by the Lord, Vedanta Krit. He has manifested it, clearly, so we can learn something. But it's not its only purpose. Just by coming into contact with Shastra in a very respectful way, we derive so much benefit. So that is a first stage for everyone. This is why Srila Prabhupada said that he wanted to see in the house of every respectable person a set of Srimad Bhagavatam. So this is why he said, give a set of Bhagavatam to all our life members. This is what he wanted, that every respectable person in society should have a set of Srimad Bhagavatam in their home. The reading part comes next. First, let there be a set of Bhagavatam. That itself is all auspicious, all pure. Krishna is personally present. And then, of course, one derives great benefit when one actually opens it and immerses oneself in the beautiful pastimes of the Lord. That's why the Bhagavatam was spoken. It's a collection of the Lord's pastimes, his activities. And just that process of immersing ourselves in his activities saves us from the pain of immersing ourselves in our activities. Our activities go on anyway. We have to do them. They go on. But we are, at least for that moment of time when we are hearing the Bhagavatam, we are transported to a different realm where all sorts of hankerings, lamentations are just set aside. At least for the time being, that's the phrase used in the Bhagavatam. And so when we meditate on Krishna's activities, we become very, very satisfied, very uplifted. And we learn so much, so many instructions come through us. So definitely we can study Shastra with a very great desire to soak up like a sponge every instruction that it's supplying. That's good. And we can also approach Shastra, that we will connect with Shastra, not in the mood of give me something Shastra, but in the mood of I am interacting with you in a mood of worship. Thank you for your presence. That itself is a very valuable way to connect with Shastra. So as we head up to Janmashtami over these next 5 days, we have a chance. We have a chance to invite the Lord. Who knows, if our invitation is strong enough, then he may actually personally manifest to us and to many people. And all of these effects could happen. Now, if they don't always happen, which is the case sometimes, that we don't necessarily see all these visible effects taking place very strongly, through the process of devotional service, we can gain the benefits of all of these. When the Lord personally comes to the earth, one thing that happens is that everyone who is present gets immediate upliftment, immediate benefit. They gain benefit because the Lord mercifully displays his pastimes to them. And so the effects are very much magnified. Disqualified, qualified, whatever, everyone gets a huge amount of benefit immediately. Now, through the process of devotional service, each of us can be in the same state as that internally. It may not necessarily manifest externally. After all, we do not see that when we practice devotional service to an exceptionally high standard that we see everything around us becomes auspicious. No, we still see lots of sinful things going on, we see lots of mess going on, we see irregularity, we see all sorts of things. Because the benefit is internal. Now, sometimes, by the Lord's mercy, if the quality of our practice is very, very high, external effects can also be visible. There are so many examples, aren't there, of great acharyas who in their meditation contemplated certain things, and then there was actually a physical consequence or a physical manifestation of that in this mundane world. You can probably think of some examples like that. But that doesn't always happen. There might be no physical change in this world, apparently. But internally, there can be a massive change. If everyone is focusing on internal transformation, then it is only inevitable that it will manifest externally at some point. So we have to mold ourselves to get into this state where we see Krishna as the source of all auspiciousness. Everything that we are trying to achieve through our abilities, Krishna is actually the source. Yatra Yogeshwara Krishna Yatra Partha Dhanurdara Tatra Shrir Vijayam Bhutir Dhruva Nitir Matir Mama. Wherever there is Krishna, wherever there is the supreme archer, Arjun, there will always be prosperity, peace, everything desirable. Tatra Shrir Vijaya, victory and opulence. That's how the Bhagavad Gita ends. This is Sanjaya's conclusion, that wherever there is Krishna, wherever there is Arjun, doesn't matter who has the bigger army, doesn't matter who has the best warriors, wherever there is Krishna, wherever there is his pure devotee, there will always be victory and opulence. So, whatever someone wants, opulence or whatever, it's available in Krishna, from Krishna, and by Krishna's mercy. And so a person turns to Krishna at all times. So as we're going through this set of meditations over the next few days, let's try and just focus more on Krishna. Focus more on Krishna, focus more on devotional service. Create in our hearts a situation where the Lord would want to appear. We have the chance as we engage in all these different elements of service through Janmashtami. Now all the hubbub has begun, you can see. There's all the frying going on in the evening, there are all the tents going up, things are, the whole, there's life returning now. It's like a bit like this. We've had a year and a half of kind of stillness. And now the fires are burning, now things are cooking. Devotees are coming, exhibits are being produced, walks are appearing, so many things are happening now. It's literally, it can be like this, depending on our consciousness. So Krishna's appearing, so let's welcome him into our hearts through this process of devotional service. So I'll stop there. If there are any questions, comments. Yes, Padam.
Thank you very much for that. I just wondered, when you're discussing
sort of the environment, I'm curious about devotee's relationship with the environment, because
it seems that, you know, if we practice devotional service, then
naturally we will not have this inclination to be excessively greedy or wanting. So in one sense we take the process and then we'll have some inclination to recycle, so it's sort of quite mundane like that,
to
like recycle, you know,
recycle
as an example. You are not to use things that are just single use or whatnot. Yeah. So there may be that inclination there, but it also seems devotees maybe have the attitude somewhat that, you know, this Krishna will take care of these things. We don't need to worry too much about endeavouring for the environment. So therefore, I feel maybe there's a slight repression of this feeling that, you know, maybe there's a natural inclination to care for the environment, but, you know, when they're in a sort of circumstance where it's not all that, you don't need to very much, you can just put things in the bin. Then this sort of natural inclination is somewhat subdued. So I was just wondering how Krishna acts, as you're saying, if people, you know, act in accordance with what he desires, then naturally everything's prosperous and auspicious. But maybe does he actually act through us, or to create, I don't really know, I'm speculating, so.
Yes, so the dynamic we have between recycling, environmental awareness, and the understanding that Krishna is actually in control. Maybe the guilt factor if we throw something in the bin rather than recycling it. We have to see in a sort of broader sense that there are multiple responsibilities within the world for multiple different people. And it is a very, very common a tendency amongst persons in the world who are not particularly religiously inclined, that they tend to point a finger at religious persons and hold them accountable for resolving all the problems that they have created. Right? So there is a great deal of disease in the world. So therefore it's the job of every religious institution to open a hospital, for example. Some people have this concept. There is a famine, there is a great deal of trouble which has gone on because individuals have artificially restricted supplies or they have started wars. And now it's God's fault because the war took place. And anyone who's a religious person is at fault because you're connected to God. So this tendency is very strong, that people hold us accountable for largely the things they've done themselves. And then they have decided what we are supposed to do. So some people come and they do a set of assessments. How much do the Hare Krishnas recycle? We're not going to consider them worthy of being in our society even if they don't recycle X percentage. Well, let's just step back for a moment. How much do you recycle? Where did this X come from? You just concocted it based upon some process that you went through, potentially with some additional assistance, some research that you did, which is flawed anyway. And we now should do this in order to counteract a situation which has largely been constructed by you not doing what we are preaching anyway. So it's kind of hypocrisy. It's an attempt to shift the burden onto someone else. Now consider every single remedy that people have come up with for dealing with environmental problems that they have created. One sort of slightly humorous one is air conditioning, right? Now air conditioning is quite nice, but in the past, now it's changing a bit, but they used to use, for refrigerants, they would use CFCs. So all these fridges and all these other gadgets which make things cool, what is the consequence did they discover later? Consequences that these CFCs go up, destroy the ozone layer, leading to global warming, temperatures increasing. So we did something amazing to keep our milk cold and ended up heating the entire earth. So their solution then is to move to an alternative refrigerant, which is produced with a whole industrial process, which itself is highly polluting. Okay, now everyone's had enough of oil. Petrol, diesel, it causes pollution. What is the solution? The solution is electric. Go electric. Okay. What does it take to have an electric vehicle? What elements are required for that? Everyone's talking about lithium right now. Afghanistan has lots of lithium. Interesting. They found some in Cornwall as well. But you need lithium to make batteries. To make an electric car requires huge amounts of extraction from the earth. And then to coordinate all the activities of those cars requires a large supply of, guess, there's another shortage going on right now, chips. Semiconductor chips. To produce semiconductor chips requires huge amounts of natural resources. Very, very rare trace elements from various parts of the world, all mined, causing great destruction to all the places there. So now look how things are evolving. A person identifies a problem, or society in general identifies a problem, that, okay, oil is bad. Then they come up with a solution. That solution itself is horrendous. It might be better in some ways. Okay, it doesn't produce gas right now while the car is running. It cleans up a little bit of pollution in the city centers, fine. But there is a huge amount of collateral damage done in the process. Huge amounts. And then huge amounts of energy required to fuel, to keep those cars running. Which comes from where? Either more fossil fuels, or nuclear, or hydro, which itself is so inefficient in an overall sense. Is there a solution? This is what those individuals who criticize us would like to say they are doing for the world. What they're doing is simply making an adjustment as the moods of society change. They're making an adjustment from one heavy ugra karma item to another heavy ugra karma item. And they're portraying it as something that we should all be doing. What they didn't do is try to reduce their consumption in the first place. Try to understand that this unlimited desire to have the latest gadgets every year and to throw them away the following year is a source of the problem. To have a lifestyle which makes you think that you need this in order to be happy. That's the problem. So we have to just be careful what our job specification is. Our job specification is not necessarily to deal with the consequences of all the problems that everyone else has created. We should be careful before we accept such a job or accept to have it imposed on us. We have to do our bit, definitely, but we're not by and large responsible for it. Our job is something different. Our job is to train people that their lifestyles, which are devoid of God consciousness, will inevitably lead to problems. Problems for everyone. Problems for every member of society. Problems for the earth itself. Problems for climate. Godless civilization causes all problems. When there is God-centered civilization, first of all, our behavior becomes much simpler, much more peaceful. We don't rape and plunder the earth as much. We live minimally. And so it is an item maybe for all of us to practice also the aspect of living simply. As devotees, you know, whether we're in the temple, whether we're outside, congregation members, we can practice living more simply than we do. That will actually have a good effect as a demonstration to people. So our job is primarily education. We, through our lifestyle, through our habits, through our realizations on Shastra, we teach people how to become more connected to Krishna and less connected to sense enjoyment, which is unlimited, never ceases. And if that becomes our focus, then we can be confident that we are actually dealing with the root of the problem, not just trying to substitute one unfashionable and visible pollution for another, less visible, maybe slightly better in some ways, but still pollution. So we have to be a little strong with this, because there are enough people who are atheistic by nature who would simply like to look for a reason to criticize us. But we focus on what we are supposed to do. In the hospital, each element has to focus on what they're doing. The surgeon doesn't need to worry about the electricity supply or whether the oxygen is being delivered and the mechanics of that. The surgeon has to focus on doing the operation. And so someone could criticize him, and you're not dealing with these other aspects. It's of no consequence. Yes, Prabhu?
Hare Krishna. Thank you for the class. So I just wanted to touch on one thing that you mentioned at the end, which was around
how with this Ratri Janmashtami, like we should really try to see the devotional service aspect of it and really try and internalize that as well.
Mm.
But what we're seeing is, at least in the past few days of field work, like it's very much in that mode of passion. And we can get into that mode, okay, you know, we just need to get it done. But then, at least personally, I feel like I might be losing that consciousness of, okay, you know, this is Krishna consciousness. Or the flip side, it might be that, okay, I'm seeing it as, okay, this is devotional service, so let me give my, like, 110%, 120% into it. But then, in trying to push myself, I might find that I'm pushing myself too much, but I don't realize it because I'm trying to focus on it being devotional service and trying to get it done. So, could you comment on that sort of balance as well as, like, how we can bring that Krishna consciousness in whilst also making sure we look after our health? Mm.
Well, this was Arjuna's dilemma in the Gita. It's Krishna. He says, you know, I'm supposed to become a saintly person, and therefore, I don't want to fight. Putting down my bow Gandiva is slipping, and he's left it. He said, I will not fight. Well, what was Krishna's answer to that? Krishna didn't say, don't do the field work. Krishna said, remember me and fight. Right? Remember me and fight. Mam anusmara yudhyacha. Keep me in your consciousness and fight. Now, do we think Arjun did a lot of field work? Right? He was roaming, he was driving a chariot around. He was on the chariot. He was doing all sorts of things from the chariot, firing weapons. He was fully busy. I don't know how you can estimate 110% or 120%. We can't generally. There's never such a thing as too much devotional service. Devotional service doesn't mean we don't do physical things either. And so it is anything that we do that is for the service of Krishna can be any activity done for the pleasure of Krishna and done to the best of our ability. So it means we have to become competent at that as well. Sometimes there's an attitude that I don't need to learn anything, I don't need to do anything, everything happens by Krishna's mercy, I can just do nothing. That's wrong also. That's not the lesson given to Arjuna in the Gita. If you understand Arjuna's own efforts, while they were in exile, Arjuna, the Pandavas, they engaged in so many activities. Arjuna engaged in many conquests. He learnt the science of weapons. He practices use of weapons. He received many weapons due to his prowess from the different demigods and others. In the Mahabharata, this is beautifully described. And he kept himself keen as a fighter, polished and able to do the task. So in the course of our devotional service, it's not the case that we don't learn anything, we don't do anything, Krishna does it all. Not the case at all. We already know Krishna is the ability in man. And we already also know that when Krishna left the planet, Arjuna was unable to lift his bow even, as described in the Bhagavatam. When Krishna left, he could not do anything. That being the case, there's a whole space in between that, where we have to utilize what Krishna has given us and prepare ourselves to be able to serve him. So, you know, if we're going to learn so many things on the field work, on the back of trucks, moving this item from here to there. In the old days, it was more entertaining. We'd sometimes put up the tents as well. Now that's been shifted off to more competent people, you can imagine, for good reason. I think over time we've learned that maybe it's best to let the professionals do this. But so many, all sorts of, there's no limit, you know? There's no limit to what services a person can do for Krishna. It's Krishna's service, Krishna's field. Literally, it's the field. You can see it as the Kurukshetra field, if you want. No, nothing is too much. And everything is too little, you could say, to keep yourself motivated.
So would you say that we should push ourselves as much as we can? Like, because the thing that I'm thinking of is there's that fine line whereby at the end of it we could burn ourselves out and then we'd just not be focused. Now part of me says that it's more Janmashtami, you know, it's for a special celebration. So it's not like we're doing this every single day.
You know, I've rarely seen in all these years that someone gets burnt out through service. Sometimes people mention this and it's discussed, but I've not really ever seen it. They get burnt out due to the weight of their own misbehavior. Never through service. I've seen people who've done huge amounts of service for years, And they're enlivened and empowered to keep continuing to do that. We have a wonderful balanced program. What we're doing, 10 days of preparation for the ashram, is nothing actually. Just 10 days, that's it. And maybe a few days at the end to clear up, is nothing in the big scheme of things. So even if we do 120% for 10 days, we should still chant our rounds. But 120% for 10 days, that's good. It's a good investment. You can't lose on that one. So sometimes when we introspect too much with and the selfless aspect, which was perhaps stronger there in the old days, you know? You hear about the stories, the devotees just went all out for Prabhupada. They didn't consider anything, they just went all out. Now we've kind of got a more balanced program. But sometimes we maybe take the balance too much into the comfort zone, where we are imagining problems before they're even likely to manifest. So sometimes we complicate things. So we already have a nice balanced program every day. So if at some points of the year we're required to go all out, that's good. That's great. But we should have enough nourishment going on through classes, through hearing, through chanting, that we are strong spiritually. Okay. Yes, Prabhuji?
I remember one devotee, he said that the book Marathon should be called the book Sprint, because a marathon is, you have the idea that you have to pace yourself. Yeah. That's just a little comment.
Yes, it's very nice. Yeah, if you know you have 10 days worth of effort to do, don't lose it all in one day. It's a valid thing. But the Jamashmi service in particular is all organized for you. It's the devotees are telling you how much to do, when to do it. So it's they've already done that calculation. It's not that you're in any danger of burning yourself out on day one. They'll make sure that you are steady. And if at times you're pushed, that's good. Imagine in the spiritual world, you do some project for Krishna. Just look at Prabhupada. How much did he push himself? He wasn't satisfied when, one temple was set up in one place. He was off the next day to somewhere else. He didn't say, I don't want to burn myself out. he started his program at the time when everyone is thinking, I'm already at the burnt out stage of my life. So when the Krishna factor is included, strange things happen. You can get energy way beyond. By the mercy of the spiritual master, a lame man can climb mountains, a blind man can see the stars. You can do work that you can't even imagine you can do. All possible, only if Krishna's connected, Krishna's involved there. And the work isn't the goal, but we do it because it's part of it. Arjuna fought. He didn't meditate, he fought. And he was told to remember Krishna. Remember Krishna and fight. Okay. So thank you very much. Srimad Grantharaj Srimad Bhagavatam Ki Sri Janmashtami Mahamohotsava Ki Hare Krishna.